From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been nonstop reaction to President Trump's claim yesterday that he could pardon himself. Today on CBS This Morning, former Republican leader Newt Gingrich said this.
If a president was dumb enough to pardon themselves, this would be such an arrogant statement of power that the House would probably impeach him within a week and the Senate would convict him.
Well, meanwhile, prosecutors are alleging that Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is guilty of witness tampering in his ongoing case of money laundering and tax fraud. Prosecutors have asked the judge in the case to send Manafort to jail until he goes on trial. And President Trump's lawyers are now saying the president dictated a statement about that 2016 meeting between his son and a Kremlin-connected lawyer. Previously, Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, said Trump Sr. had nothing to do with the statement. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is here. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And start with Paul Manafort, central to Robert Mueller's investigation of possible collusion between Trump aides and Russia. Remind us why and what he's being accused of now.
Well, Manafort is an important figure because of the role that he played in the Trump campaign. He was a Trump campaign chairman in the kind of thick of the presidential race in the summer of 2016, and then, of course, also took part in that meeting in Trump Tower with the Russian lawyer. So what prosecutors said in a filing last night is that in February, April of this year, Manafort and an associate tried to contact two witnesses to get them to provide false testimony to investigators. Now, this is tied to secret lobbying work that Manafort was engaged in related to Ukraine. He had secretly organized a group of former European politicians to basically lobby for Ukraine. He funneled money to them through bank accounts outside the U.S. What prosecutors say is that Manafort reached out by phone and encrypted messaging apps to try to influence the testimony of these two witnesses who worked for a PR firm. Manafort wanted them to say that the Ukraine lobbying work was exclusively in Europe, so not in the United States as well. This is important because Manafort has been charged with failing to register as a foreign agent, which relates to lobbying work in the U.S. What the witnesses did is they provided these text messages to prosecutors, to special counsel Robert Mueller's team. One of the witnesses also told investigators that Manafort's outreach was basically a clear attempt to get this individual to commit perjury because the witness knew that the lobbying had actually taken place in the United States. Now, there's been a statement from a spokesman for Manafort today, and he said that Manafort is innocent. Nothing about this latest allegation changes our defense. We will do our talking in court. They will have a chance on June 15th. The judge in the Washington, D.C. case has set a hearing for that date for to address these allegations.
Okay. We will follow that. And now we need a whiteboard for this next one. There's the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders and her refusal to comment yesterday on statements she and others made that President Trump did not write that statement about the meeting his son had, we mentioned, with the Russian lawyer in 2016. Remember, the statement said the meeting was about adoptions. Emails revealed the Russians had told the Trump people they had dirt on Hillary Clinton and actually in the meeting had asked for an easing of a sanction. But now there's that letter from President Trump's independent lawyers to the Mueller investigation that was obtained by The New York Times on Friday. That letter says, in fact, Trump Sr. did dictate the statement that the meeting was about adoptions, which it wasn't. And here's a bit of the exchange between Washington Post reporter Josh Dossie and Sarah Sanders.
I can't comment on a letter from the president's outside counsel. I direct you to them to answer it. John?
Sarah, the words are literally, you said he did not dictate. The lawyer said he did. What is it?
I'm not going to respond to a letter from the president's outside counsel. We've purposely walled off, and I would refer you to them for comment.
Look, the White House does seem to be caught in a lie here. Last night you had Rudy Giuliani, who told CNN's Chris Cuomo that, you know, Jay Sekulow wasn't lying when he said that President Trump had nothing to do with that statement. He made a mistake. We all make mistakes. I've made mistakes. But what is the bigger picture here? Because it seems that there has been falsehoods. Why would the lawyers, the Trump lawyers, now tell Mueller that the president did dictate that statement in that letter?
Well, they actually told they wrote that letter back in January. So it's not that they're telling Mueller now. We're just finding out about the letter now and about the way that they are presenting the dictation of that letter. Sorry, of the statement that the president made after the meeting. I think that the bigger question here is not so much the shifting answers that we're getting from the White House and the president's personal legal team and what we're hearing in the public. The bigger question, I think, is what have White House aides and Trump associates who worked on the campaign told Mueller's team in interviews and grand jury testimony. That's where they could get caught up in a lie that would actually have legal significance. What we hear from the White House podium matters in terms of politics. And yes, you generally want what you're hearing from the White House to stack up with reality. But inconsistencies, that's more of a right. political question than it is the legal question.
So in other words, someone who's already testified before Mueller might have already told them that President Trump dictated that letter. Hence, it gets in the letter from the lawyers. We'll follow this one right. as well. With NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Protests continue in Jordan, and they're some of the biggest anti-government demonstrations in years. The protesters angry about austerity measures, including tax hikes and price increases. The country's prime minister resigned yesterday. A new prime minister was appointed today. Joining us from Amman is the BBC's Mark Lowen. Mark, what are you seeing there today?
Well, during the day, of course, Jeremy, we're still in the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, so it's fairly quiet. The protests get going in the evening after the iftar meal, breaking the fast. And last night I was out with the protesters late into the night, and they were very spirited. They were still quite numerous, at least 2,000 of them marching on the main street towards the Prime Minister's office, some celebrating the resignation of the Prime Minister, Hani Mulki, yesterday. But others still saying that it is not a change of personnel that they want, but a change of policy, a change to this deep austerity that they say is making their life extremely difficult, which is a demand of the International Monetary Fund in response to the huge $723 million loan that they want. So today we have a new prime minister who's been named. He's the outgoing education minister. He's a popular choice. The king says that that there will be a discussion on a very controversial income tax bill that sparked the protests. But really, unless there is a fundamental change in policy, it seems that these protests will continue.
Well, tell us more about this new prime minister. His name is Omar Razaz. Who is he?
He is a Harvard-educated former World Bank economist, and he's been a popular education minister. He was a popular choice to be named the new prime minister. He engages with young people on social media. He's sort of seen as quite dynamic, quite secular. So he has the credentials, certainly. The question is whether he can unite the government on the challenge that Jordan faces, which is satisfying its lenders, the International Monetary Fund, while placating an increasingly frustrated population. This is a country where the price of fuel has been hiked five times since the start of the year, where electricity prices have gone up by 55% since February. Bread subsidies have been scrapped. And then there is this controversial draft bill that I mentioned to increase income tax. And all of this is really getting people very, very frustrated in a country where there are over a million Syrian refugees, there's a chronic shortage of water, there's a booming population. So there are all the ingredients there as a sort of toxic mix for social unrest. And that is the task now of the new prime minister, to try to placate all of that.
And this is reminding a lot of people of the Arab Spring, where in many countries the economy was the reason people got so upset. Is it fair to call this a new Arab Spring in Jordan?
No, it's far from that. We're still only talking about a few thousand people in Amman and then a few isolated protests in the rest of the country. But Jordan largely escaped the protests of the Arab Spring in 2011, partly because the king and the monarchy generally is a fairly stabilizing factor here. The security, for example, the security forces they tend to act fairly in a restrained way towards protesters. You don't see them opening fire or really scuffling very badly with protesters. So, you know, they're trying to contain all of this. We're far off any kind of, you know, Arab Spring here. We're talking about social unrest, which is the worst in Jordan for 5 or 6 years, but it is still relatively contained. But even that, Jeremy, worries countries like the US, for example, which is a key ally of Jordan, because this country, Jordan, has always been a key pillar of stability in the Arab world and an important Western ally, and they need it to stay that way.
Well, that's the last thing I want to ask you about, is how this plays into the politics of the region. Jordan, obviously, is a country that's very close to Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, Israel, all the countries that we talk about in the news all the time.
Yeah, it is. And that is just why it is so important to, I suppose, keep a lid on this or to resolve this issue, because King Abdullah himself today said Jordan is at a crossroads. Either it chooses a more dignified life for its citizens or, God forbid, in his words, it goes into the unknown. Nobody here wants that. It is a relatively stable country, albeit with economic problems, but surrounded by this kind of arc of instability. With the Syrian refugees creating extreme burden here, with all the conflicts around it, with Syria, Iraq, etc., and Jordan being a key security ally of Israel as well, it needs to maintain that path of stability. So I think that moving forward from this, clearly the king, the new prime minister, will choose dialogue. They will try to resolve this peacefully rather than allow this unrest to spread.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen joining us from Amman, Jordan. Mark, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Last February, we spoke with John Ledoux of Waseca, Minnesota, one of dozens of thwarted school attackers across the country. He was building bombs in a storage locker in 2014 when he was caught. He told us about his downward spiral, a good student who started seeing other kids goof off and still get ahead of him.
It kind of bothered me watching people mess around, and I wasn't enjoying things. I looked around and people were enjoying stuff, and I was just kind of living day to day, just existing. So it was more fueled by my slew of disappointment and frustration that led me to want to be violent, is because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically.
Well, John got arrested, served time, accepted a felony charge, got help. He told us he's now embarrassed that he ever thought of hurting others, is sick at every new school attack. We learned so much from John Ledoux, but he returned home to a wary Waseca. So today, what's it like to be the parent of a thwarted attacker? David Ledoux, his dad, a steel worker, says the obvious, it has not been easy. But at one point, he joked about starting a GoFundMe page to ask people to help his family move since they felt so unwelcome. David, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
This decline that he described, we heard from an awful lot of people at that time who said, well, I have a child who feels this way about himself. I mean, it's frightening to people because it could be a lot of young people who start to feel that sense of, you know, lack of satisfaction and resentment of other people. Did you notice it?
Yeah, I did. It seemed a rather mild case of it.
Yeah. How would you have described your son back then?
Seemed to be doing fine, very attentive to detail, motivated in his pursuits, not very interested in anything that wasn't on his radar.
We read a story you told a local paper about how in fourth grade, John, your son, donated his entire savings, which was $200, and good for him in fourth grade, to a fundraiser for a child who'd been killed along with his father by an intruder. You were surprised that he did give his full savings.
Yeah, I was. I was very surprised because his reaction seemed quite muted. Like a lot of his reactions, he wasn't a very, what I would call an extremely outgoing person. So,
is there anything you could have learned from this? Or like some of the other parents of thwarted school shooters, it was such a shock that, you know, as you go over it, is there anything you feel you can impart to another parent? Anything maybe you overlooked? Anything you could have followed up on?
Possibly. I don't know how in the current environment. It's very strange. I guess anything that I felt was a concern, most people that I know would think I'm kind of an extremist and that I'm making kind of worrying about phantoms, you know, being his lack of violence or even general lack of anger issues. You know, he might have had frustrations over things and we talked about things, but there's nothing really concrete to hang on to think I should demand more interaction with him and him to explain to me why he seems to be increasingly reluctant to spend more free time around other people rather than spending more time by himself.
He was a loner, and that's what you thought.
Right. I spent a lot of time concerned about violence and wondering about violence in movies and violence in video games and the murder videos that are available online. That's just shocking. I had complained to my daughter about that separately, about a coworker watching these execution videos all the time at work. And she said, oh, I know, that's terrible. That's going on in school all the time. All these kids in homeroom, well, there's four kids or five kids are all sitting together watching these execution videos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then to find out that John was doing that too. covering his tracks good enough, we didn't see it. But I can only imagine what that does to people to watch that. If you watch it enough where you start to get inured to it, like John said, I assume that's what he was trying to do, is trying to put himself in that mindset where things don't matter. I don't care about things. And there's things out there that, like I said, I think we're really not giving due credit to how much violence is out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big censorship person. So if we're not going to censor everything, and of course we can't, what's the best thing to do is stay close to your kids and friends and family and keep them informed and talk about these things and pay attention to people's behavior. And the year before, he wanted to put a lock on his bedroom door. And I was like, absolutely not. And he actually bought a hasp and a lock. And I was like, I noticed he had my cordless drill out and he was in his room. I was like, what's this for? Oh, I wanted to put this on my door. I was like, what? Mm. No. I guess later he found somebody that would rent him a storage locker.
Mm.
My biggest concern was when he expressed a belief in atheistic outlook, and some of the statements he had made were very concerning to me, and most people that I know would think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Not all atheists are violent people, and he certainly hadn't been a violent person, but the negativity that he was beginning to express was a quite mild version of it. This kind of negative outlook on people and why we're here and made me feel compelled to pray for him. I asked for intervention on his behalf, and within 2 weeks from that day, we certainly got it.
Oh, so
we got it way more than we would have ever imagined. And it was interesting. I found myself sitting talking to my son at Red Run Creek Juvenile Detention Facility, talking to him about parables in the Bible as he was trying to understand them, as he was given one there and was having difficulty understanding it. And I just thought, here we are 3 months ago. I was praying for an intervention, and now here he is willing to contemplate things in life that he hadn't been prior to that. So I guess I got what I was asking for. Very thankful for it that nobody was injured, especially himself or his friends.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people were thanking God that there was an intervention, and you are attributing it to God. But
yes.
You know, you just must have been sweaty with relief.
I was relieved, but very fearful for him, what would happen to him in the system. I knew they wanted to put him away for 40 years to life.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the reporting and some of the facts, I think, got very convoluted, which made it very much a public issue here.
Well, can you understand? Because they thought they had a potential, they did have a potential school bomber. I mean, you're right. He didn't do it. But,
right.
You know, they had to be incredibly careful. They don't know what they might find in your house. You could have been in danger.
I understand they needed to be careful, but I wish they would have been careful to clarify that there were no guns in the storage locker. All the guns were mine. All the ammunition was mine. Anyways.
Does it bother you that John planned to use your guns? Some people, you know, avid gun owners are thinking twice about maybe locking up their guns. Not even, you know, just not just from a child, but from somebody who's emotionally disturbed and might want to take their own life. Are you thinking twice about that?
Not really. I don't have the guns that I had because most of what I had was hunting weapons, for one for him and one for his sister and one for me, of several different types of guns. I was the one that put the gun safe in his room that Christmas after he had turned 17, and I was gone very often in the evening, and he was the only person at home that I wanted him to know where the guns were and how to get a hold of them. Now, in light of all this, of course, that's a question. That's a big question. I know it's not an unusual situation for a 17-year-old in this town to know where they can get their hands on a shotgun. That would be a big change as far as keeping everything completely locked away. But, of course, yes, I do because, well, first of all, I'm not worried about him. He's like a poison-proof dog. You could leave a loaded gun on the table and he wouldn't touch it.
Look, your son told us that physically what he was doing, plotting, building, was making him sick. He was tired of it. It's almost like he wanted to be caught. Do you trust that he is the young man we spoke to who said he has remorse and he's glad he was caught? He's embarrassed by it. He has advice for other people. You know, if you are feeling these feelings, talk to someone.
Yeah.
That he learned that there's a different way to, you know, he didn't have what he wanted in life, and he learned there's a different way. I love how he said, it's like driving a car. If you steer it correctly, it'll get you pretty much anywhere you want, but crashing it doesn't usually bring you to your destination.
Right. Oh, yeah, I do. I do trust who he is. He's the one that doesn't want any more trouble. He's the one that's a felon.
He chose a felony rather than probation. The felony could have been lifted, but he didn't want to go on a lengthy probation. And now, you know, other people are watching and they're nervous. This is happening, by the way, in towns across America. There's a town in Vermont that's closely watched. Do you actually ever speak to the parents of thwarted attackers?
No, I haven't. I've sent a card to a couple people where things have happened. You know, like I think it was a town just north of here. A kid posted a picture on Facebook or Instagram of an AK-47 with the words, "See you at school." And he's charged with felony. He's hauled off to jail. I haven't heard any further developments of that. Mm-hmm. I think I have a pretty good idea how they feel.
Yeah. Well, and it brings us back to your son who went really pretty far, you know, building bombs.
Yeah.
What's life been like for you in Waseca, for you and your family?
Sometimes people look at me, and I don't know if they're looking at me because they know who I am or because I'm just walking the opposite direction. I'd be happy to talk about it, but almost nobody's ever stepped over at our house to talk about this.
What's the one thing you'd want to tell people about John, your son?
I don't have good words for that. And I think the best example is to talk to John. I'm thinking how we would deal with other troubled people we know, you know, like mm-hmm. your uncle or your nephew or someone else that you're concerned about, that you're wondering that they're okay. Don't hesitate to pray for people or to talk to people. Try to be positive to people. That's what I try to do. I try to be positive to people. And if people are concerned about your son, you know, you could do something, you know.
That's David Ledoux. His son is John Ledoux, a thwarted school attacker in Minnesota in 2014. David, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Again, there are dozens of young thwarted school shooters across the country living with dozens of families, and David Ledoux says, talk to them.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
U.S. Energy Secretary Rick Perry is defending an order from President Trump last week to help revive unprofitable coal and nuclear power plants by forcing grid operators to buy electricity from them.
The president is right to view grid resilience as a serious national security issue, and he's directed me to prepare immediate steps to stop the loss of these critical resources.
Perry speaking in Austin yesterday. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, this idea that this is about national security, this is what the administration is also saying about tariffs. But in this case, it's a way that they can force grid operators to do this because in order to force them, there has to be a crisis.
That's right. And so the White House has said in a statement that the retirements of these what they call fuel secure power facilities are leading to a rapid, this is their words, a rapid depletion of a critical part of our nation's energy mix. So they're identifying nuclear and coal-fired power plants as fuel secure. They're also saying that they, you know, these shutdowns are happening too rapidly and that any reliance on one type of resources is a potential fuel security risk. Now, the trend over time is that America has started to rely more and more on natural gas. We've got a lot of natural gas. We have a lot of coal, but we have moved to natural gas. It's a little cleaner, and you generally find natural gas where you find oil, which we've been drilling for a lot of. So plants that produce electricity tend these days to prefer to produce natural gas, and they've got to make a switch. You can't do, you know, natural gas 1 year and coal mm-hmm. 1 year. So they're switching out of these old coal plants that are 40 and 50 years old into natural gas, and the government is now getting involved in that.
But the grid operator PJM Interconnection disputed this idea that there are security concerns, saying in a statement that the grid was more reliable than ever, in part because of renewable fuels.
Yeah, so here's where the White House and the Energy Department are taking issue with what PJM and other grid operators are saying. They're saying resilience, which is what they want for national security, is different from reliability. So most outages to date on grids have been caused by some sort of a distribution interruption, usually triggered by weather. They're saying, the Energy Department is saying, that there are going to be high impact events caused either by state actors through hacking, through terrorists, or major natural disasters, and that requires resilience as opposed to reliability. Some people think that's splitting hairs at this point.
Well, and this does seem pretty far from conservative ideas to have the government interfering in the market to this degree.
Yeah, it's very far from natural from conservative ideas. And in fact, typical conservative ideas would be to say we've got a homegrown energy source like natural gas, which tends to be a little bit cleaner and is readily available and abundant. Let's do that. This, of course, has more to do with the fact that the president has campaigned on the issue of keeping, in particular, coal-fired plants up there. It seems like they've thrown the nuclear thing in to sort of strengthen the resilience, natural security, national security argument. But it doesn't go in line with conservative orthodoxy typically.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Let's now consider wrong-way driver crashes. Now, they are relatively rare, just between 1 and 3% of all traffic accidents. But because of the head-on nature, they're 12 to 27 times more fatal. Every year, between 300 and 400 people in the U.S. are killed on average, usually on highways with exit and entrance ramps because of drivers entering the wrong way. And if you've ever been barreling down a highway, as I was, with a pickup driving straight at you, well, it is terrifying. Bumper cars. Thankfully, in that case, no one was hurt. A couple of years ago, we spoke to officials in Rhode Island who are installing radar-activated warnings to cut down on wrong-way crashes. Arizona implemented a new $4 million system back in January. It goes a step further, and they say they've kept a dozen vehicles from entering the wrong way on one stretch of highway. Arizona State Department of Transportation engineer Dallas Hammett joins us now. And Dallas, we've all seen the standard, you know, wrong way signs, but tell us how your system works. How does it detect the cars?
So our system uses a thermal camera. So we actually get a video feed through our thermal cameras, and we have multiple detection sites. So at the ramp where you would enter a freeway ramp, we have cameras there that would detect a wrong-way incursion onto the ramp, which activates a number of things. First, we activate an illuminated sign, which would alert the wrong-way driver that you're going the wrong way. It also alerts my traffic operations center, so we can immediately start moving law enforcement. But it also goes right to the law enforcement folks, so they can start responding. Further down on the freeway ramp, we have another camera. So if we're fortunate enough that that driver sees the signs that come up and self-correct, we know that they did not enter the freeway. Those cameras at the lower end of the ramp also track them. Mm-hmm. So once they get, if someone got on the freeway and make it to the next mile, we can track and know where that wrong way incursion is as they travel along the freeway.
Right. And you also can activate a system that alerts other drivers on the road?
That's correct. We have the big message boards on the roadway. At the point where a wrong-way driver is detected, those will automatically illuminate those signs and say, wrong-way driver ahead.
Exit the freeway. Get off.
That is correct.
Look, part of the problem with the wrong-way crashes is, first of all, people are impaired many times, and so they may not see that sign that's there, just the standard sign in the ground. These big flashing signs may catch their attention. But also, by the time, as I was, if you're in traffic and you see that wrong-way driver coming and you're calling 911 as they make their way behind you down the road, it's too late.
That's correct. Our freeways are wide out here in Phoenix. And one thing we've learned is the wrong-way driver often is in, if you're going the right way, the left lane, their right lane. And so if you're traveling in that lane, and you're going 65 miles an hour, and they're coming at 65 miles an hour, you close very quickly, and you don't have a lot of time to react.
Yeah. But I'm understanding that you're only doing this along about a 15-mile stretch of Interstate 17. This goes through Phoenix between the I-10 and Loop 101 interchanges?
That's correct. This is a pilot, if we see that it working successful and our early results are successful enough that we have another 22-mile segment of roadway in construction now, it is putting in the same system. We're also putting the thermal cameras in at spot locations as we do upgrades. This is our system that we're using now. But the pilot system is that 15 miles that you talked about.
Well, and as I said, many wrong-way drivers are impaired. And we know that just in March, your governor there signed a bill making wrong-way driving under the influence a felony. So there's obviously concern about it.
One of the things we found, that about 65% or more of the wrong-way fatals involved an impaired driver. So as you said, the governor, working with the legislature, we put tougher laws out to deter those folks that could be impaired from staying off the roads completely.
How many calls are there? I mean, we've been talking about the accidents, but about how many calls come in with people citing wrong-way drivers?
So law enforcement, and they go to our highway patrol, they say they get one per shift. Last year, they had over 700 calls in for wrong-way drivers. The challenge with that is you don't know if there's multiple calls per incident. What we're excited about are detection. Now we see and we can confirm that it is a wrong-way driver, and we can confirm did they enter the freeway or not. The other thing that this will do for us is alert us sooner. In one case, we tracked a vehicle that not on our test site, but we have cameras in other locations, that a wrong-way driver got on the freeway, and it was 5 minutes later before the first 911 call. We were able to stop them working with law enforcement before we even got the first call.
Oh, that's great. That's Arizona Department of Transportation State Engineer Dallas Hammett with their new program there, the Wrong-Way Driver Alert System. It alerts the drivers that are getting on going the wrong way, and it alerts drivers on the highway that somebody's coming their way going the wrong way. Dallas, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now to news that is just unfolding today. New York City police have confirmed that fashion designer Kate Spade has died. Born Catherine Brosnahan, the 55-year-old was found unconscious at her New York home, pronounced dead at the scene. Diana Sue, senior fashion editor at The Cut, is with us. And Diana, I know you're just taking this in, but how is the fashion world receiving this?
It's a huge shock to the fashion community. Kate Spade was a very much beloved brand with a lot of history in the American fashion community. So right now, everyone's just in mourning, in shock, and just, you know, trying to remember her as best as we can.
Well, she and her husband, Andy Spade, launched this company in the early 90s. It just exploded. For people who are, you know, it's ubiquitous, but for those who are trying to picture it, what was a Kate Spade bag? What was a Kate Spade? What was the sign of it?
So Kate Spade exploded in the 90s, and the quintessential Kate Spade bag was a nylon tote. It came in an array of colors. There was black, white, red. It had little handles, and there was a little black tag on the front that said her name in lowercase, Kate Spade. Mm-hmm. Of course, that exploded into a complete lifestyle with other bag designs, with home, with fashion, with shoes. Yeah. She started with a humble nylon bag that really just enraptured the girls of the 90s. You couldn't walk through New York without seeing them on every woman's hand.
Yeah, I mean, she just really hit the jackpot. But then at one point, Kate Spade sold her stake in the company. And last year, Coach bought it for $2.4 billion. Reportedly, she did not get anything from that sale because she'd already taken her stake.
Right. So she had parted ways with the company in 2007, and she decided to take a step back from the industry. She actually came out with a shoe line called Frances Valentine, named after her daughter. Kate Spade was always a very creative woman with a very clear vision of what she loved and what her customer loved. So she came back with a shoe brand that really was geared to have women fall in love with shoes. The world is a very different place than when she left her brand in 2007, and she knew to adjust to the changing climate that she would have to come up with something different.
Yeah. But do we know how she felt about this huge sale of the company that she birthed? And now there are over 140 Kate Spade retail stores around the country, and they have her name, but wasn't involved in it.
I think when anyone sells their brand and sells their name, there's definitely an understanding that the brand will continue without them, but still within their vision. She's never publicly commented on how she felt about, you know, the current state as Kate Spade was sold to Coach and became Tapestry. But I think she left her brand with the understanding that her legacy lived on.
Do we know any reason why, you know, she might have left the world today? Do we know any more?
We honestly don't know. It's so difficult to say when it comes to suicide. It's really hard. No one wants to speculate on her emotions, especially for the sake of her family. And, you know, there's the only thing you can do is to honor her legacy and talk about the good that she has done for the fashion world.
Well, and you said suicide, but I'm not sure that's been officially confirmed. But Kate Spade was 55. She leaves her husband, Andy, with whom she founded this company that just took the fashion world by storm in the 90s. They also had one daughter. Kate Spade has died at 55 in New York. Diana Sue of The Cut, thank you so much.
Thank you.
With high school and college graduations, Father's Day, and wedding showers, June is a big month for parties. And if you're looking for ideas for what to serve at your next event, you're in luck because Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is in the studio with some ideas. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy. Hello, Robin.
I'm tweeting. I'll be right with you.
Oh, okay.
Tweeting pictures of the food.
Right.
Kathy, what are some things to keep in mind if you're having a party this time of year?
Well, I say this over and over, but I'll say it again. Keep it simple. As much as I want you to try all these recipes, it's not necessarily the best time to try brand new recipes.
When you're going to have people over who actually have to enjoy them.
Right. You want some of your tried and true, although what is wonderful about all these recipes is that they're very straightforward and, as you're about to find out, quite delicious and simple. It's summer. We want to eat a little bit lighter. We want healthy, vibrant flavors. So I tried to focus on that, putting together a menu. And you literally have an entire meal in front of you.
Okay.
So.
Well, let's start with this big thing here because
this
I just tweeted out a picture at Here and Now, Robin. You can see it. I mean, this looks like a meal in and of itself.
This is so beautiful. This is a grilled flatbread, and you're not going to believe me when I say it is just flour and water.
You made the flatbread.
I made the flatbread.
Okay.
But it is from a book called Repertoire. My friend Jessica Batalana, San Francisco-based cookbook author, it's her recipe, and I was very suspicious because you have to do things like roll it into a circle and then make a cigar out of it and then roll it again. It's stuffed with fresh cilantro and scallions. Mm. You make it in about 20, 30 minutes, and you throw them straight on a hot grill. Mm. So what I would do is have all your other food ready, get everybody outside, throw these flatbreads on, and eat them hot.
It's interesting because these days, flatbread is like another word for pizza, but
exactly.
This is not a pizza.
No yeast. No. It's a no yeast dough. And what goes with it is also from Jessica Batalana's book, is a marinated butterfly of lamb. It's called a butterfly of lamb because it's a leg of lamb where the bone is taken out. It's got an incredible amount of great herbs, mint, oregano, ginger, cumin, coriander, allspice. You just rub the herbs on, throw it on the grill. Very, very simple, but a pow of flavor.
Takes you right to the Mediterranean.
Exactly. And then for the non-meat lovers, we have grilled shrimp. And shrimp is not the sexiest seafood, but it turns out it's the one everyone loves. There are so few people that will say, nah, I'm not going to eat. I don't eat shrimp. All I did was grate some lemon zest on it, olive oil, lemon juice, salt and pepper, put them on a skewer with a big hunk of lemon at the end, so the lemon grills also, and throw it on the grill.
Please tell me you have a trick for taking the
yes,
and the
ask
shell.
Me ask me why I shirt. Left it on.
Yeah,
okay?
Why did you leave the shell on?
I thought you would never ask, because you are going to have a juicier shrimp. Just rip it off. Rip the tail off. Seriously, pull it from the side.
But grill it with it on.
Because the juices stay within. If you take the shell off and
here
good
I'm choking.
Sound effects, Robin.
I know, but
you're doing it close to the mic.
I'm choking over here on eating the shell.
No, do
but
not
you take
eat
it off.
The shell. Okay. But, you know, of course you could take it off before, but I feel like the shrimp dry out that way. And next to it, you have a very vibrant green sauce, which is a combination of basil, parsley, capers, pickles, olive oil, a sauce that lasts for a week, a sauce that goes with shrimp or any other type of grilled seafood, lamb, flatbread, anything.
It looks kind of like a chimichurri, but it's different.
It's like if chimichurri and pesto had a baby, it would be that green sauce.
That's kind of disgusting.
So,
okay.
Not really. I think it's kind of cute.
Okay. All right.
Keep tweeting, right?
How do we do the potatoes here?
The potatoes are a Greek style. They have fresh lemon. You'll notice lemon is a theme through this. And they're roasted. I just peel them, cut them in wedges, throw them in the oven, do them in the morning. You can serve them room temperature.
So they're so soft, though. Because they're peeled.
They're peeled. And, I mean, they're tender and they're still a little juicy. And hopefully you get the fresh oregano and lemon.
You know, a friend of mine just told me the other day that every time I eat something I like, I go, Well, and I just did that with these potatoes because they're delicious.
Shocking. So first good. Time for everything. Right. I want you to say, but also let people know this is a great collection of foods. It would be a terrific party any time of year, but for June. And then dessert. We can't
forget dessert.
Yeah. So I made a biscuit. It is a very simple biscuit, and the trick with it is twofold. I grate the butter. Instead of having to crumble it up into small pieces, the largest opening of a cheese grater, you grate it. I add a little bit of ground ginger, and I make the biscuits and freeze them. And they go straight from the freezer to the oven. I bake them this morning, and they still are tender and fresh. Vanilla-scented whipped cream, fresh strawberries. You could add a rhubarb puree, any fresh summer berries. A really great way to celebrate the season and make individual desserts for all the people coming to your June celebration.
You know, it's so funny. I know I've been kind of quiet over here because I'm just eating. It's just eating.
The way these Thank always goodness. Work.
It is radio. So these dishes that you can serve at your next summer party, from here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, or to the radio hosts that happen to drop by, are at hereandnow.org.
Hereandnow.org. Crash the website, as you always do with these segments. Kathy, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.